I would hope that people who are broken or see a brokenness around them will turn to prayer and will turn to God and to their love of Christ and the Trinity to help them in their own small ways, either shift their mentality or possibly also shift their action.
Heidi J. Hornick is professor of Italian Renaissance and Baroque art and chair of the Department of Art and Art History at Baylor University. A recent guest at BYU, she's also the author of several books, including one we discussed with her today, The Art of Christian Reflection. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Heidi, it's great to see you. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
It's wonderful to be here, Matt. Nice to see you as well.
I've got to say, it was more fun to see you here in person when you were our guest a couple of weeks back. It was a very full day when you were here, too full for us to record this interview then. But thank you for coming back to talk with me over Zoom.
It was a great trip and it was a full day. And this was nice also because it allowed me to have a little bit more thought, meditation, reflection on that experience. So thank you for everything related to it. It was fantastic.
That's great. Thank you. So if you've listened to past episodes of the podcast, you know, I usually begin by asking my guests how faith figures into their life and work. Now, you're an art historian and much of your work is focused on religious art. And my question, I guess, is this: did your love of art and your appreciation of religion develop together, or in your case, did one precede the other?
I think it was certainly my religion preceded my love of art. I'm from New York, was raised Roman Catholic. So from a very early time in my life, I was very much aware of my tradition and of Christ. So art became a wonderful kind of manifestation of a lot of the stories I had learned and read about, and really a trip to Italy my sophomore year of high school kind of tipped the clock.
It's done that for a lot of people, trips to Italy, I think. Yeah. So you took a trip to Italy, and now, of course, you're professor of Italian and Renaissance and Baroque art. And my question really is now is for Heidi, the seasoned art historian, you know, kind of the astute and educated critic. Do you still feel inspired by beautiful art and especially religious art? Or do you find that the more you learn about it, you know, the more you learn about the aesthetic principles by which such art is produced, like perspective and composition, blend of color, et cetera, that all of that understanding diminishes in some way the spiritual aura of the art? I guess putting it a different way, do you find yourself these days almost compulsively drawn more by what you discern about artistic craft and how art achieves its effects than you are by the sheer experience, almost the devotional experience of the work?
That's a very good question. You know, it really is the history of art. So when you have a subject like that, of course, you're enthralled with what was life like at that period for that artist working on that painting, sculpture, work of architecture. So I think it's hard to separate them out. But for me, when I'm doing something, and if I think about it in terms of teaching, if I'm working as chair for 2 hours in the morning and then I walk into my classroom at 11, that art, which in this case is Artemisia, so Gentileschi, so it's you know, incredibly religious, Old Testament, New Testament, that really takes over, you know, and then it really becomes, okay, let's talk about Susanna and the elders. Let's talk about David and Bathsheba. Let's talk about the penitent Magdalene. And then I'm kind of less concerned about as much of the technical aspects. So I do find that through teaching, it kind of keeps it fresh and keeps it spiritual, actually.
That's great. That's really good. I know that it can. I mean, when you learn a lot about how something is done, it can change how you experience, right? Whether it's you learn a lot about how scripture was composed, that's the thing, the German higher criticism, or what you learn about how art produces its effects, it can have an effect on the magic. But it's great that you kind of retrieve some of that in the experience of teaching it. And that kind of love for the art communicates itself in this really great book that you wrote, The Art of Christian Reflection. This is the book that you discussed when you came to BYU a couple of weeks ago. And we'd invited you a couple of years ago, but this thing called COVID, right, it gets in the way. Now, while the project is a book, and it's a beautiful book, it appeared, the essays in this book, the chapters in the book, first appeared in a different form. Can you explain what the project was that initially generated all this great material?
Yes. And I'd be happy to, because it really was a project that began when my second son had just been born. He is now almost 24. So for 16, 17 years, four times a year, I wrote these essays. And I wrote them with a editorial team that got together once a year and kind of mapped out that year's journals. So each one had one life, I guess. And then when the series was complete, it was the Center for Christian Ethics, excellent editor, Bob Krushwitz, who was director of the center. And he was the main editor. And I, of course, was doing the art editing, and there was music and worship. So, it was a great team, and it was very exciting to kind of work these issues out. But then when it ended, I realized I had 120 works of art with all of these essays. And I thought, what can I do with this? And so that's when the book became a great, great idea, the best of kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. And it is a beautiful book, and it does have kind of an organic quality to it. Did you find that in going back over these essays that you needed to revise them drastically or add new chapters or new sections and find new images and so on? Or did you really find the thing really hung together already as a book kind of ready-made?
It did not hang together, honestly, as a book ready-made, at least not from my point of view. And even though the series had stopped and a couple of years had passed, I was still too close to it, honestly, to see it in any other form than the one I originally constructed it for. So Bob Krushwitz, the editor, I went to him and I said, you got the big picture, how can I reconstruct this? And he actually came up with the three different divisions. And then I sorted them all out, figured out which ones fit where. And I think it worked very well. And so it went to 80. I think we have 80 color images in the book, which of course was enough. I didn't have to do all of them. and then I rewrote, because again, 18, 19 years, the literature was old, the scholarship was old. My life had changed. As I mentioned, I had raised two sons. I had been at a career for 25 years, taught for 25 years. And so I wanted to adjust them to me, adjust them to the scholarship. And that was great, because that was the project that I did during research leave and fellowship at Harvard.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the book reads, it reads like a very lively set of thoughts that are very present, very current. It doesn't read like things that are showing their age. Once in a while, scholars write collections of things, that's like a greatest hits, of past. And you can tell the difference between something published 15 years ago and something published, just right then in the book. But your book has very much like a fresh feel all the way through, which is great. So the book's title, The Art of Christian Reflection, kind of points to what the book does, right? It reflects or comments on Christian themes and art. And, it's difficult to capture such a, beautifully visual book in an oral medium like a podcast. But perhaps we can talk about some of the themes in your book, at least, and your commentary on them. So you structure the book, I guess Bob Krushwitz suggested this, and these three chapters or divisions. The first one is Christian Habits and Virtues. The second, moral issues facing contemporary Christians. And the third is formative and liturgical practices. The first chapter underscores several character traits to becoming a mature disciple, as you put it. And you emphasize these ones: forgiveness, friendship, patience, and generosity. Were there others that also leapt to mind for you? Why focus on these ones in particular?
Well, I think they worked together as a group. I think each of these are, if you can, kind of virtues. They're kind of things that we all hope to achieve, succeed at, develop into. So that's why I selected those. Also in there was Singing Our Lives, which was a little bit more of a practical application. How do the Psalms get us back to Christian reflection? So that one was nice too in that group.
Yeah, it is. So explain for those who don't have the book in front of them. And my hope is that people listening to this will want to look for the book. It's a beautiful book. But explain kind of what this looks like. So you have a section on forgiveness, for example, right? You know, what then do you do? How many pages is that? How many works of art? And are these most of the sections the same across the book, or do they vary in length and vary in numbers of artworks? And how does the book kind of look like? What's the layout of the book?
Well, there's usually two formats. The forgiveness one that you mentioned contains three color images of three scenes: the prodigal son in a sculptural example, the expulsion from the Garden of Eden in a painted example by Cole, and then finally Poussin's Sacrament of Penance. And so you have these three beautiful color images, and each one is discussed in terms of setting the stage historically. I am still a historian, about, you know, a little bit about the artist, a little bit about the period and the culture. And then I go into more of a interpretation. Bob and I called them FIAs, formal iconographic analysis. So there's a little of that formalism. You know, what was revolutionary with their painting style, for example, but it very quickly gets to the religious iconography and that kind of an analysis. And so this grouping of three is about 1500 to 1700 words. And then sometimes I will do just a single image. I don't know what the first example of that is. I prefer actually the three, but I think vocation in that same group, that first section, just has one picture. It has Caravaggio's Calling of St. Matthew. So then I just talk for about 750 words, 800 words, just about that one subject. Because as you know, that's a powerful image and it's a powerful message. When Matthew is called by Christ with Peter at his side in the tavern.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous image. All these images in the book, Heidi, are so striking. They're just beautiful. And I love the artistic commentary and the way you tie it in to these really important themes. And so, for example, I'm looking here in your book at page 3, you know, and you talk about kind of this Baroque work of art, the prodigal son. You mentioned the Baroque artist dispenses with linear narrative. He rivets our attention on the drama and its momentary effect on all the characters. The father's startling unconditional forgiveness is the focal mystery, both for his sons and servant and for us, the viewers who now observe it. It's a great point, right? Because the prodigal son, of course, is a story, but this is a sculpture you're talking about. And you talk about how the sculpture kind of brings the entire narrative, the linear nature that it down to a focal point. And it points at how the art then works to bring attention to this dramatic moment in the narrative that really reveals both the story and the theme all in one space.
That's the goal, you know, and it's also the kind of thing where, of course, I would love for people to, you know, pick up the book or even just Google these images that we're talking about so they can see them. But the best papers, the best articles are written with descriptions that your mind's eye creates that image. And no, of course, it's not exactly the same, but that reflection, that thought process of using my words or anyone's words to recreate that visual allows a lot of personal experience and personal interpretation. I mean, we're always throwing around the idea of, you know, critical thinking and critical analysis. Well, what you're doing when you listen to those words is critically thinking and creating an image in your mind. So that is one of the benefits of the podcast. So people will create their own images as we go through.
Very good. All right. Now, you also do, I make in the course of these different essays in the book, a series of kind of cultural observations that bring a lot of these themes into very much the present. And there's one here still in that section on forgiveness where you remark, I'm quoting you here, that Henry James believed that Americans suffered from a dangerous Adamic innocence, the conviction that all ills can be cured with a sufficiently ingenious application of human intelligence. In other words, we think that nothing is deeply broken, so we do not need forgiveness. Okay, that's a really savvy insight, I think. But today, you know, it's several years after you first wrote that essay. And a lot of Americans today look around at our society and we see it as almost irreparably broken. And I'm wondering whether you share that sentiment about kind of the brokenness that we feel as Americans. And if that's the case, do you think it's made us more inclined to seek forgiveness, or are we as little inclined to seek it today as we ever have been?
I think I would hope, and I guess that really is both my hope and my prayer, that people who are broken or see a brokenness around them will turn to prayer and will turn to God and to their love of Christ and the Trinity to help them in their own small ways, either shift their mentality or possibly also shift their action. Because what you bring to each morning and what you bring to each conversation with every person can be easy to complain. We're all very good at complaining. It's much easier to find the negative part in something than to find the positive. So COVID, for example, yes, it delayed my visit, but I think it was a better visit, because the book marinated a little bit more with you, with me. It was something we both anticipated more than just check it off the list, one more thing to do when it was originally planned. It would have been great, but I think just that, so, you know, again, that's kind of looking at it as, okay, yes, COVID caused our world to be broken in so many different ways, irretrievably, and we don't even know the effects of that. But at the same time, some positives have come out of it, especially in terms of the vaccination, for example, you know, and this ability for science once again to assist us, maybe imperfect at this point, but move us along to regaining whatever a normal society might be. So, yeah, that's probably my best answer for that.
That's a good answer. And I think it illustrates in a lot of ways right there, your answer right there, Heidi, what the book is really designed to cultivate in readers. Because, you know, you find yourself with these familiar Christian themes, but set alongside these beautiful works of art. And the point is really to elicit something like reflection on what these things mean, not only in the present, but in history, but also not only in history, but in the present. And I think that example of, you know, thinking about what forgiveness might mean in the present, especially in a society broken by a pandemic, for example, what that might do, which is great. In a later section on vocation, you mentioned this section a moment ago, you make a really provocative comment. You say, and I'm quoting you here, "We do not simply choose a course of action, but respond to a summons, which often is against our will and involves hardships." Have you experienced this yourself? And have you felt yourself called to do something that otherwise you would not have done?
If you had asked me 2 years ago, I probably would have struggled for an answer, honestly. But again, kind of a positive or even a revelation because of COVID, we had a search for the chair of the department. I've been in this department for 31 years. After the first chair, 20 years, retired. I was not interested raising my boys, getting my publications, not interested. Then my next chair retired 2 years ago, still not interested. We began the search. We got one candidate in. COVID hit. So there was no one to do the chair, the position I never aspired to, never wanted. But I always say I was kind of the last person standing meets designated survivor. I was called to serve. I felt called to serve. I felt my mother, who we had lost during COVID, she was a very she was a community servant both in our schools and in our churches. In our church. And so I felt her presence that this was something I did need to do. And you know, if anyone's been a department director or chair or in any kind of position of authority, it's not an easy job. And it goes on hours after hours. There's always an email. Whether it's personalities or facilities. And I have a wonderful department. But even with a wonderful department, student needs, curricular needs, it just goes on and on. So, but that's okay. You know, I did it last year as an interim, went really well. So I'm doing a 3-year term now. But that probably has been the best example I have there of call to serve and with some hardships.
Yeah,
it's tiring. Not easy.
Yes, that's right. You know, it's not easy being a chair. And just the personnel matters are complicated because you have a lot of people in a department who are trying to do really good things. And so, they're trying to find ways to make things happen. So they ask questions of you, you know, can this happen? And sometimes where you can make it happen, you do, but where you can't, you have to say no. And so then people get upset or their feelings are hurt or they're wondering, why couldn't I do this if so-and-so, I started something similar about 5 years ago. And it's complicated. And so it is kind of thankless labor. So that is a good example. That's a great example of vocation. Yeah. Thank you for that. Moving on to the book here a bit, the second chapter of your book is titled Moral Issues Facing Contemporary Christians. And this is the biggest, longest chapter of the book. And it takes up a number of themes. And I'll mention here, you know, but they fall into categories like concerns facing our friends and families, other relationships. And I'll kind of go through another list here of these. You talk about schools in a pluralist culture. You talk about virtual lives and reality and about gambling and women in the church and suffering, racism, freedom, anger, patterns of violence, built and natural environments. You talk about prison and aging and health and death and consumerism. And food and immigration and caring for creation, peace and war, Christianity and Islam. And I probably left off a few here. If you were writing a book today and you dedicated your attention as an art historian and as someone living in the present to one of these topics, what topic would that be and why?
Well, I think some of them would work very well together. I know you mean just one, but say, I guess I'm grouping again, suffering, aging, health, death. Yeah. Those four right now in our culture scream out at us. What I would do with them and how I would frame them, I know it would start with, for me, it would start with a recollection of the last 2 years of my mom's life. She did suffer from dementia, not incredibly old, in her 80s, but had weakened health. And of course, it led to death. So for me, those things are front and center still, you know, even though she died on April 8th of 2020. And so I'm always grasping for works of art, things, passages, things to meditate on. And I think for me, those four, to go back to those four and try to make them relevant for people through art today would be a good task. I really do. And I think most of the time, the 750 word ones that I talk about focus very quickly on that application. and that relevance to our culture today. And it does. The fascination, it's almost become a fascination with death. And if we could even segue to my visit when I was there, when we went to the Family History Museum, and thinking about your ancestry and the Church of Latter-day Saints, as I now understand its idea of a spiritual realm for the ancestors before the second coming, that's always fascinated me as to where are we going? What are we doing? Where are our dead? Where are our loved ones? And so, and we also, you know, you lose a parent, you think about your own death, you think about your own health, you think about your own mortality in your own spirituality. Where will you end up? So those are the things that are kind of on my mind now, and probably would be the book that you talked about.
That's a really great answer, Heidi. And that would be, I know, as if we each had, you know, multiple lifetimes, I could write all these books that come to mind, but that kind of book, you know, on, you know, aging, health, aging, suffering, death, you know, but thought about not only in terms of what that means for our society, but what it means for spiritual life and what it means for, you know, sort of theology and religious conviction. That would be really amazing. I'll ask you later on about your experience there at the church's Family History Library. Time permits, because that was such an amazing experience, even for me to be there with you, you know, for that. But to bring in these kinds of reflections into a discussion of what these themes mean in a way that's familiar to everybody, I think would be really terrific. So at some point, Heidi, okay, if you ever are lacking for a project, okay, there's one that would really work. I should also mention, along with these themes, the range of artists in the book. I mean, only a few, but it's such beautiful art, but, you know, pieces by Caravaggio and Cole and Poussin, Bassano, Rembrandt, Raphael, Manet, Hopper, Dali, and so many more. I've got to ask, do you have a favorite in this book of beautiful images?
I have a favorite of probably the artist none of your listeners will have heard of. His name is Michele Tozzini. All my family is Michaels or Josephs. I married into the Michaels. I came from the Josephs. But Tozzini was a Michele, a Michael. And he was my master's thesis project, my dissertation. I wrote the first biography on him. And there are two images by Michele Tozzini. He was a 16th century Florentine mannerist, painter, late Renaissance painter, good friend of Michelangelo. Letters with Cosimo Primo de' Medici of Florence include his name, Giorgio Vasari, if people know who that is, the first biographer of artists, writing these down. And so it has to be Tozzini. There's a marriage of Cana scene in the marriage chapter, and the St. John the Baptist is also in the book. So those are my favorite. Second probably would be Hopper. Edward Hopper's from my hometown in Nyack, New York. And so he's one of my father's favorites, as well as Manet. So those are three.
That's a nice range, you know, the Tozzini, right, from the Renaissance era, then Hopper, you know, Manet, much more modern. That's delightfully eclectic. I love it. The book really does, even though you're a professor, you specialize in Italian Renaissance and Baroque art, but there really is a lovely range of work in it. It's beautiful. Now, your concluding chapter on formative and liturgical practices observes something about mysticism that I find provocative. And as I'm quoting you here, you write, mystical experience is not an accomplishment, but a gift from God. Yet we may adopt some of the mystics' practices. They can teach us spiritually transforming ways of reading scripture and repair our love for other people and the world. I love mysticism myself. That's a good observation, Heidi. And I'm wondering, does visual art communicate these lessons, or does it convey different ones, something about mood or attention or discernment or something else?
Well, I think art is personal, right? Right off the bat. When you go into a museum, you're attracted to a particular work of art, and that becomes... you become that audience for that work of art, and you become the interpreter at that moment in time in that museum, or flipping through a magazine, a photo that attracts your attention, something that strikes a chord for you at that moment in your life. And so the mystics, and I think the Bernini was the one that I had put in there, the Ecstasy of Saint Teresa from the 17th century, she was open to receiving whatever message, as were the other mystics, that came to them. And maybe foreign or maybe too far off the spiritual scale that may seem in our everyday lives, every time you encounter a work of art, you are open and receptive to what that work of art has to say to you, how that fits in your life at that moment. And you mentioned this, it's eclectic. It's got something for everybody pretty much. And that's exactly why I did it that way. And what you like one day may not be what you like a month or a week later. You may be drawn to something because your daughter likes it or my son likes it. And so this kind of openness, I feel, is the closest thing. And then in terms of the spirituality, those of us who have a Christian bent towards interpreting things will even see that in some secular images, some genre images, some images that aren't typically part of the Christian war horses of art history, if you follow.
Yeah, great. I love the that discussion of yours, the point about openness, which it's such a lovely trait in general, you know, to be open to other people, to open to the world, open to God. And how art kind of cultivates, nurtures openness as an attitude. And it's a great plug for the virtue of studying art, really studying the humanities more generally. It opens us to human experience in ways that otherwise wouldn't occur to us. That's an excellent point.
Very much so. And people probably experience this first with music. I mean, when you hear a song, it takes you back, right? It puts you in a place. It puts you in a frame of mind. Good and bad, you know, a good experience, a sorrowful experience. And so when you add visual art to this, you remember where you were and what you were looking at, and usually who you were with when you begin to speak about that art, especially for the first time. People remember when they saw the Mona Lisa for the first time. People remember when they saw Michelangelo's David for the first time, the Vietnam Memorial. I mean, everyone has these moments, and that's exactly what the liberal arts should be giving to us as humans, and certainly religious art as Christians.
Yeah, thank you. I'll ask you one more question about the book, then we'll turn to a couple other subjects here. And as you think, not about any particular section in the book, but about the message of the book as a whole, what point do you think it makes about the relationship between Christian art and virtue?
I think the biggest goal, let's say, I had was that people learn more about the work of art that they're interested in or attracted to. So, for instance, we started with the Prodigal Son. Everyone knows the Prodigal Son story. They may know the Rembrandt painting, which is probably one of the most famous renditions of that subject. But what do you know about Rembrandt? What Mount Tauti, who I illustrated the sculpture that we spoke of earlier, what do you know about him? So my goal was here to not only create a natural conversation about Christian art and the message, the biblical message or the scriptural message, but also get people one step deeper into art history and into history and the culture in which these artists live. So, and working in other, you know, other areas, I think, as you know, with my husband, Michael Parsons, who's a biblical scholar, I've watched very learned Christians and scholars of the word just plop in images. And okay, prodigal son, here's a prodigal son. Oh, okay, good Samaritan, here's a good Samaritan. And I'd be like, wait, go back. You know, you know, you're missing so much by not knowing who Jacopo Bassano is or why he did a Good Samaritan, etc. So that was my hope, was really not just to give personal reflections on Christian virtues or Christian art, but to unify them in a very full way.
Yeah, lovely, which is great. And thank you for doing that. It's a beautiful book. I love it. Now, we've been talking about that one book, but you've written or edited several books, including some with your husband, Michael Parsons, whom you just mentioned. One of these books was recently published. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. The most recent one that Mike and I did was The Acts Through the Centuries. Mike is a specialist in the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles. So the first series we did was Illuminating Luke, and we did subjects with that were unique to the Gospel of Luke, as illustrated in Italian Renaissance and Baroque. Then a modified version of that happened with Acts of the Apostles, where we focused on visual depictions of the Acts of the Apostles. And those were all more, when you say something is not scholarly, it creates a negative impression, which is not at all what this Christian reflection is. But those books were more academic, let's say. And so there was a lot more commentary and interpretation by him and by me in our respective disciplines. So, and then actually the one that just came out 2 weeks ago, I actually edited with two other colleagues, not Mike this time. And that was a collection of essays from art historians and biblical scholars that were presented at the Society of Biblical Literature, which meets, of course, with the American Academy of Religion every year in November, largest academic society. And it was papers that were given there by these colleagues. And so we edited them into a gorgeous volume that range, again, very eclectic, large range of topics, and just different ways then for people to interpret visual art and the scriptures.
Yeah, okay, great. You mentioned a conference at the Society of Biblical Literature and the American Academy of Religion. It's actually being held this month, November. And I'll see you out there in Texas. It's held in San Antonio this year. Just a couple of weeks, which will be fun for me. Looking forward to that very much. And meeting Michael would be wonderful. Let me ask you about your work at Baylor for a moment, where you've taught for many years. How do you understand your role there as a professor of art history? Is it different than it would be if you taught at a public university or at a private secular university?
I do think so. I mean, I've been here a long time now, but I still see the difference between syllabi or conversations I have with other colleagues from state universities. And I went to Penn State for my PhD, and so that, you know, I was part of that system, and I went to Cornell as an undergrad. So I was part of that kind of private system. But I think Baylor, especially when it comes to our students, they want to be a part of our mission, which is to educate men and women in a Christian community. And so when I teach Christian art, there's a lot of previous knowledge. There's a lot of familiarity with the subjects that I teach, especially in my advanced classes, but even on the survey level, which I keep my hand in. I mean, most senior professors don't want to teach survey anymore. I love teaching survey. I love teaching sophomores and getting them excited about prehistoric to 1400 or Renaissance to the present. And now most of us have been trained, I think all of us actually have been trained in the Western civilization and culture. And we are trying to move now to a more global survey. So that's kind of my next project. And I hope to be able to do that in the next, you know, 10 years, final 10 years of my career type thing.
Okay. You know, what you say about Baylor and the interest of the students in the religious tradition, that really resonates for me, you know, working at BYU. And I've been here now for 21 years at BYU. When I first got here, you know, I kind of imagined, I looked at it kind of kind of backwards, I think, in some ways. I assume that the church is what we all have in common. So my job here is to instruct students in, you know, kind of the historical, cultural, secular tradition to, you know, expand their worldview. And that's not incorrect, but it's limited. And I've the last several years I've realized, no, and there's so much more you can do at a place like this to incorporate all of those wonderful, you know, sort of secular, cultural, historical, et cetera, philosophical contexts with these Christian ideas, themes, doctrines, theologies, and spiritual traditions, and really enrich learning experience, really explain why these things have profound meaning. And I've really come to relish working at a religious university for that very reason, like what you're talking about working at Baylor.
Yes, I think especially now, if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education or any of the sections of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, everyone's talking about how deep-seated the depression and anxiety that is caused now as people who had been forced into isolation, young people, our students, forced into isolation, forced into Zoom classrooms, not have graduations, not have proms, and now they're re-entering. And so we're supposed to be more patient, and we're supposed to be more generous, and we're supposed to be more encouraging. But I feel like Baylor and probably BYU has already had those natural traits in the way we handle ourselves and the way we interact with colleagues and students. And, you know, maybe as lengthy as the days are being chair, they're also the most productive because I am able to help people during this difficult time or get them to the appropriate help if it's beyond me. But most times people just want to be heard. They just want you to hear that this has happened or that's happened, and they have to have their project a little later or their paper due an extra 24 hours, you know. But to get back to this, I mean, that is a Christian community. It's not being lenient. It's not being, you know, lowering your academic standards. It's just being Christian in your mentality and how you deal with each other. A day-to-day basis now that we're all struggling to do this at this point in our civilization.
Yeah, that's right. And that, I think I love that point, Heidi, and really to accentuate what makes these communities important, why we believe, not just why we fought fascists we have to, but why we believe in community and how we go about doing that in the best way. In a Christian sense, I really admire what you do and try to, you know, sort of generate that best I can, cultivate it, you know, on my own part out here at BYU. Let me close by going back to an experience you mentioned a few minutes back about your experience in the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints' Family History Library. And that was, so I met you, stayed in Salt Lake City, right, at a hotel there. And I met you in the morning. We had a couple hours, we had to come down here to BYU. So it's like, well, what should we do? Let's go there. And do you want to just talk about your experience there at the library? Because it's better hearing it from you than from me.
Well, I it's famous, of course. So I knew it was something I wanted to do. I had no idea it would be the entire 2.5 hours that we had to spend together, you know, getting to know Salt Lake City. But you know, you were very generous with the amount of time that you had allowed me to stay. So I did get to see the other things as well. But as far as the Family History Museum, what a resource and what a receptive group of people who, again, didn't know me at all, but simply wanted me to learn about my family ancestry and heritage. And that was inspiring from the first person to the fifth person, I think, who was helping me. And so what we did, and I had names and approximate years for both sets of my grandparents. I'm only second generation American on my father's side, the Hornick side. And so we started there, and my father is still living, so he was not in there, but we worked our way back. And some of the documents that were probably the most exciting was trying to find the city from which my grandparents came. I knew they both went through Ellis Island. I knew approximately when. I even knew who their sponsors were. And so I think Alan was the gentleman who actually found the marriage certificate from the Roman Catholic Church, St. John Nepomucene, which, because the Catholics, not quite as well as the Church of Latter-day Saints, but the Catholics do base all of their documents on the church that you are baptized or christened in. My sister has done this with her children, my brother with his, myself, all of us were christened and baptized in St. John Nepomucene. So there it was. There was this state of New York marriage certificate, and then it had their parents' names. And that just, you know, got me more excited. And then the fact that their sponsors, who brought over these 14 and 16 year old kids from Slovakia, they were their witnesses. And I recognized those. And it listed my grandfather as a baker, which he was. He was a baker in a wonderful Jewish bakery in Manhattan, and the streets they lived on. Which, of course, streets don't change, just the function of them in New York City, right? So yeah. So that was all very, very exciting. And at one point it was frustrating. And I think you mentioned this when I did my audible at your church service, that the lady, when the first lady could tell that I was getting a little frustrated, because I thought probably that was it. And she said, "Don't worry, your ancestors will help you." And it went in one ear and out the other, you know, but when you came back to it in church, when I was at the service the next day with you and you were introducing me, or it was the conclusion of what I had said, I thought to myself, that's what they're talking about. That's what you believe. And that's a wonderful entree into learning some of these things. And I've gone on a bit here, but I just had my follow-up Zoom meeting day before yesterday. And now we're trying to get the baptismal certificates from these small communities in Slovakia, which of course are two different parish churches. And the woman who helped me, McKenna, a couple days ago, found my grandmother's listing. And her, I've known her as Josephine Nemacek, who became Josephine Hornick. And the marriage certificate said Josephina. And so I asked my dad about that. And he said, no, she's always been Josephine, but I do know she spelled her name differently. Well, this document that we found, which was a registry that would refer back to the documents that I can now ask for, actually had her name as Josepha, J-O-Z-E-F-A, Nemacek. And the birth year was correct. The city was correct. And this was, the last name was spelt correctly. So McKenna was very sure that this was, in fact, my grandmother, which almost came full circle, because I always use the middle initial J and my middle name is Josepha.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's an amazing story, Heidi. That really is. It was really moving to sit there with you. And I wasn't on the Zoom call 2 days ago with you, obviously, but to be there in the library when you found that marriage certificate that listed all these details about your grandparents, it was really exciting. It was really moving. And I was grateful that you shared that experience with my church congregation a couple of days later. It was great for others to hear. I've heard back from other people since then about how great that was. It's inspired them to look more into their family history. So thank you for doing a good work there. It's such a delight to see you, Heidi, and to talk with you. You were such a wonderful guest at BYU, and you've been so great to talk to today on the podcast. It's a real joy to talk with you, and I'm grateful to call you a friend.
Well, I thank you very much for your hospitality, for your interest in the book, for the engaged audiences that you put me in front of. It was an amazing experience. Bobby did a great job. Abby did a great job. And you are gifted at this. So BYU and the center is very, very fortunate to have you. And I also appreciated meeting your wife, Carrie. And I look forward to you meeting Michael here in Texas in just a few short weeks.
Can't wait. Yeah. Thank you so much, Heidi. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.